quickly remembered his aunt's commands. He seized the slave by the arm, though still terrified for those behind him at the ford, and dragged him into the twisting woods, along the paths he knew, even in the semi-darkness, away from the river. They struggled forward together, holding one another in the screaming, frigid gale, Tavi filled with a sense of gratitude that there was another living human being there to touch. He was unsure for how long they struggled away, their path winding forward and then slowly uphill, before he heard the flood waters. They rushed forward, nearly silent, preceded only by a whispering sigh and the groans of a thousand trees stirred in their ancient earthy beds. To the top of a hill, Tavi and Fade struggled, and he turned back to see, dimly through the ferocity of the storm, the dancing of the trees, that some pent-up tide had been loosed from up the stream of the rill water. The little river had exceeded itself and flooded its banks, and those cold, silent waters began to swallow Bitan's fires as swiftly as they had spread. The waters rose, and in that screaming cyclone of the fury storm, Tavi was uncertain how anyone, even his aunt, could survive such an onslaught of the elements. Terror rushed through him, pounded through his veins with his blood. Darkness swallowed the land as the silent waters of the flooding river swallowed errant flame, and in moments the were-lightning of the fury storm flashed green and eerie to show Tavi which way to go. In silence he turned back to his path and stumbled forward, leading Fade. Twice wind manes swept toward them, but Tavi's salt crystals, though partly dissolved from their time in the water, drove them away. They made their way from the twisting wood an endless time later. Fade let out a sudden yelp and threw himself against Tavi with a sob of fear, forcing the boy down, the slave's heavy body atop him. Tavi wriggled and struggled to get out from under Fade, but only managed to free his head enough to crane his neck over the man and to see what had frightened him. Around them stood a silent half-circle of Marat warriors, unmistakable with their pale braids and powerful bodies, clad, even in this vicious weather, only in a brief cloth at the hips. Each of them stood very tall and more broad in the shoulders than Tavi could easily believe, with dark, serious eyes the same shade as the chipped stone, tipping their broad-hafted spears. Without expression, the tallest of the Marat stepped closer. He put his foot on Tavi's shoulder and rested the tip of his spear against the hollow of Tavi's throat. Chapter 22 Fidelius twisted himself up and out of the chilling waters of the angry river, frozen fingers clutching hard against the branch of the tree he had crafted within his reach. He felt numb, and his heart labored painfully against the shock of the cold water. The cold beckoned him with a slow, seductive caress, encouraging him to simply sink into the waters, relax, let his troubles slip away into the darkness. Instead, he secured a hold on the next higher branch and hauled his body up out of the water. He huddled there for a few moments, shaking, struggling to gather his wits about him again, while the fury storm raged around him, winds hauling at his sodden clothes. The one good thing about the flood, he decided, about the freezing water, was that he could no longer feel the cuts on his feet. He'd done his best to ignore them while recovering the horses, but the rocks and brush had been merciless to his skin. The woman, the water crafter, had been on to them from the beginning, he decided. Clever, getting his shoes like that. She'd been planning on the boy running and on hampering pursuit. Fidelius leaned against the trunk and waited for the waters to subside. They did, in rapid order, proving more than anything else that the flood had been a deliberate crafting rather than a natural event. He shook his head. Odiana should have given them warning, but perhaps she had been overmatched. The locals were no amateurs at their fury crafting and had lived with the local furies for years. They would know them, be able to use them more effectively than even a crafter of Fidelius's own level of skill. The Steadholder, for example, he had been formidable. In a direct, fair confrontation, Fidelius was uncertain whether or not he could simply overcome the man. Best, then, to ensure that any future contact with the fellow discounted the possibility of a fair fight. But then, that was in general Fidelius's policy. Once the waters had receded back down into the river's original bed, Fidelius slipped down from the tree, grimacing as he got back to the ground. The pitch of the winds had only increased since the storm had rolled over them, and surviving in it had to be his first priority. He knelt by the trunk of the tree, resting a hand lightly on the sodden ground, reaching out for Vama. The fury responded to him at once, vanishing into the deep earth for several moments before rising back up toward him. Fidelius cupped his hands, and Vama returned, providing what it had been sent to retrieve, a handful of salt crystals and a flint. Fidelius pocketed the flint and swept the salt into a pouch, keeping a few pieces in hand. Then he rose, noting how slowly his body responded, and shook his head, shivering. The cold could kill him if he didn't get warmed up, and quickly. Rising, he dispatched Itan to look for signs of his companions, and Vama to search through the surrounding earth for signs of movement. If the locals, either the Bernard Holters or those they had been fighting, were still at hand, they might feel few compunctions about finishing the job the watercrafter had started. Fidelius had to hurl salt at a swooping wind main while he waited for his furies to return to him. It didn't take long. Itan appeared within a few moments and led him forward through the blinding storm, down along the path of the river. Several hundred yards downstream, Fidelius found Aldrich. The swordsman lay on the ground, unmoving, his fingers still locked around the hilt of his sword, buried to its hilt in the trunk of a tree. He had apparently managed to keep the flood from sweeping him away entirely, but had not taken into account the threat the elements represented. Fidelius checked the pulse at the man's throat and found it there, still strong, if slow. His lips were blue. The cold. If the swordsman was not warmed, and quickly, he would die. Fidelius debated allowing it to happen for a moment. Odiana remained an unknown quantity, and as long as she had Aldrich with her, she would be difficult to move against. Without the swordsman, Fidelius could remove her at leisure, and if Fidelius was fortunate, perhaps Aldrich's death would unhinge her entirely. Fidelius grimaced and shook his head. Aldrich could be arrogant, insubordinate, but his loyalty to Aquitaine was unquestioned, and he was a valuable resource. Besides which, Fidelius liked working with the man. He was a professional, and understood the priorities of operating in the field. Fidelius, as his commander, owed him a certain amount of loyalty, protection. Convenient as it might be to him in the long term, he could not allow the swordsman to come to grief. Fidelius took a moment to draw strength from the earth, pouring into him in a sudden flood. He jerked the sword from the tree's trunk and peeled Aldrich's hand from its hilt. Then he picked up the man and slung him over one shoulder. His balance wavered dangerously, and he took a moment to breathe, to steady himself, before taking up the naked sword and turning, with Aldrich, to march away from the river, up out of the flood-saturated ground of the river's course. Vama shaped out a shelter from a rocky hillside, and Fidelius ducked into it and out of the storm. Itan provided ample kindling and wood, and Fidelius managed to coax a pile of shavings into flame, using the flint and Aldrich's sword. By slow degrees he built up the fire, until the inside of the fury-crafted shelter began to grow warm, even cozy. He leaned back against the wall, his eyes closed, and dispatched Vama and Itan again. As tired as he was, there was still a job to do. Fidelius remained silent for a moment, letting his furies gather information about those who still moved in the wild storm outside. When he opened his eyes again, Aldrich was awake and watching him.
"He found me," the swordsman said.
"Yes."
"Blade isn't much good against a river."
"Hmm."
Aldrich sat up and rubbed at the back of his neck with one hand, wincing, gathering himself back together with the resilience of his craft, and of comparative youth, Fidelius thought. He wasn't young anymore.
Where's Odiana?
I don't know yet, Fidelius said. The storm offers considerable danger. I've found 2 moving groups so far, and I think there's at least 1 more that I can't pinpoint.
Which one is Odiana in?
Fidelius shrugged.
One is heading to the northeast, and 1 to the southeast. I thought I felt something more directly east of here, but I can't be certain.
Northeast isn't anything, Aldrich said. Maybe 1 of the Steadholds. Southeast of here there isn't even that. Turns into the Wax Forest and the plains beyond it.
And east is Garrison, Fidelius said. I know.
She's been taken, or she'd have stayed close to me.
Yes.
Aldrich rose.
We have to find out which group she's in.
Fidelius shook his head.
No, we don't.
The swordsman narrowed his eyes.
Then how are we supposed to find her?
We don't, Fidelius said. Not until the mission is finished.
Aldrich went silent for several seconds. The fire popped and crackled. Then he said,
I'm going to pretend I didn't hear you say that, old man.
Fidelius looked up at him and said,
Aquitaine assigned you to this personally, didn't he?
Aldrich nodded once.
You've been his right hand through most of this. You know all the details. You're the one who has handled the money, the logistics. Yes?
What's your point?
What do you think is going to happen if the mission fails? If Aquitaine is in danger of exposure. Do you think he's just going to give you a wink and a nod and ask you not to mention it where anyone could overhear? Or do you think he's going to make sure that no one ever finds your body, much less what you know about what he is planning?
Aldrich stared steadily at Fidelius, then tightened his jaw and looked away. Fidelius nodded.
We finish the mission. We stop whoever is going to the local count, send in the Wind Wolves, and turn the Marat loose. After that, we'll find the girl.
To the crows with the mission! Aldrich spat. I'm going to find her.
Oh? Fidelius asked. And how are you going to manage that? You have many skills, Aldrich, but you're no tracker. You're in strange country with strange furies and hostile locals. At best, you'll wander around lost like an idiot. At worst, the locals will kill you or the Marat will when they attack. And then, who will find the girl?
Aldrich snarled, pacing back and forth within the confines of the shelter.
Crows take you,
he snarled.
All of you!
Assuming the girl is alive, Fidelius said, she is quite capable. If she has been taken, I am sure she is well able to survive on her own. Give her that much credit. In 2 days at the most, we'll go after her.
2 days,
Aldrich said.
He bowed his head and growled.
Then let's get started. Now. We stop the messengers to the Count, and then we get her.
Sit down. Rest. We've lost the horses in the flood. We can wait until the storm is out, at least.
Aldrich stepped across the space between them and hauled Fidelius to his feet, eyes narrowed.
No, old man. We go now. You find us salt. And we go out into that storm and get this over with. Then you take me to Odiana.
Fidelius swallowed and kept his expression careful, neutral.
And then?
Then I kill anyone that gets between me and her, Aldrich said.
It would be safer for us if we...
I couldn't care less about safe,
Aldrich said.
Time's wasting.
Fidelius looked out of the shelter at the storm. His body ached in its joints, groaned at the abuse that had already been heaped on it. His feet throbbed where they were cut, steady, slow pain. He looked back to Aldrich. The swordsman's eyes glittered, cold and hard.
All right, Fidelius said. Let's find them.
Chapter 23.
Amara had never been so cold. She swam in it, drifted in it, a pure and frozen darkness as black and as silent as the void itself. Memories, images, danced and floated around her. She saw herself struggling against the swordsman. She saw Bernard on his feet and coming toward them. And then the cold, sudden and black and terrifying. "The river," she thought. "Isana must have flooded the river." A band of fire settled around her wrist, but she noted it as nothing more than a passing sensation. There was just the darkness and the cold, the burning horrible purity of the cold, pressing into her, through her skin. Sensations blurred, melted together, and she felt the sound of splashing water, saw the cold wind rippling across her soaked skin. She heard someone, a voice speaking to her, but the words didn't make any sense and ran too closely together for her to understand. She tried to ask whoever was speaking to slow down, but her mouth didn't seem to be listening to her. Sounds came out, but they were too cracked and rasping to have been anything she meant to say. Sound lessened, and the cold lessened with it. No more wind? She felt a hard surface beneath her, and lay there upon it, abruptly and overwhelmingly tired. She closed her eyes and tried to sleep, but someone kept shaking her just as she was about to get some rest, waking her up. Light came, and an ugly, unpleasant tingling in her limbs. It hurt, and she felt tears come to her eyes, simple frustration. Hadn't she done enough? Hadn't she given enough? She'd already given her life. Must she sacrifice her rest as well? Coherence returned in a rush, and with it pain so sharp and rending that she lost her breath and her voice in the same gasp. Her body, curled into a ball, had tightened into a series of cramping convulsions, as though doing everything in its power to close itself off from the cold that had filled her. She heard herself making sounds, grunting noises, guttural and helpless, but she could no more stop making them than she could force herself to straighten her body. She lay on stone, that much she knew, in the clothes she'd stolen from Bernard Holt, but they were soaked through with water, and crystals of ice were forming on the outermost layer of cloth. There were sloped walls of rough stone around her that had stopped the howling winds. A cave, then, and a fire that provided light and the warmth that had brought tingling pain flooding back into her body. She was freezing, she knew, and knew as well that she had to move, to get out of the clothes and closer to the fire, lest she sink back into that stillness and never emerge from it. She tried. She couldn't. Fear filled her then. Not the rush of excitement or the lightning of sudden terror, but slow, cool, logical fear. She had to move to live. She could not move. Hence, she could not live. The helpless simplicity of it was what stung, what made it real. She wanted to move, to uncurl her body, to creep closer to the fire. Simple things, things she could do at any other time. But for lack of that ability now, she would die. Tears made her vision blur, but they were half-hearted, too empty of the fire of life to warm her. Something came between her and the fire, a shape, and she felt a hand, huge and warm, blessedly warm, settle on her forehead.
"We've got to get those clothes off you," Bernard rumbled, his voice gentle.
He moved closer to her and she felt him lift her like a child. She tried to speak to him, to help him, but she could only curl and shudder and make helpless grunting sounds.
"I know," he rumbled. "Just relax."
He had to struggle to get the shirts off, though not much. They were so large on her. The clothes came away like layers of frozen mud until she wore only her underclothes. Her limbs seemed shrunken and wrinkled to her. Her fingers were swollen. Bernard laid her down again close to the fire, and its heat flowed over her, easing the cramped tension in her muscles, slowly lessening the pain that had come with it. Her breathing began to be something she could control, and she slowed her breaths, though she still shivered.
"Here," Bernard said. "I got it wet, but I've been drying it out since we got the fire going."
He lifted her, and a moment later settled a shirt, a little damp, but warm with the heat of the fire, over her. He didn't bother to slip the sleeves on, just wrapped her in it like a blanket, and she huddled under it, grateful. Amara opened her eyes and looked up at him. She lay curled on her side. He sat on his legs, holding his own hands out to the fire, and was naked above the waist. Firelight played over dark hairs on his chest, over the heavy muscle of his frame, and made soft lines of several old scars. Blood had dried in a line on his lip, where a blow from the other steadholder had apparently split it, and his cheek had already darkened with a bruise, reflected by others on his ribs and belly.
You came after me, she said moments later. You pulled me out of the water.
He looked over at her, then back at the fire. He nodded once.
It was the least I could do. You stopped that man.
Only for a few seconds, she said. I couldn't have stood up to him for long. He's a swordsman, a good one. If the river hadn't flooded when it did.
Bernard waved his hand and shook his head.
Not that one. The one who shot the arrow at Tavi. You saved my nephew's life.
He looked down at her and said quietly,
Thank you.
She felt her cheeks color and she looked down.
Oh, you're welcome.
After a moment she said,
Aren't you cold?
Some, he admitted.
He nodded toward where several articles of clothing were spread on stones near the fire.
Brutus is trying to spread some heat into the stones beneath them, but he doesn't really understand heat too well. They'll dry in a while.
Brutus? Amara asked.
My fury. The hound you saw.
Oh, she said. Here, let me.
Amara closed her eyes and murmured to Cirrus. The air around the fire stirred sluggishly, and then the smoke and shimmering waves of warmth tilted, moved toward the clothing. Amara opened her eyes to inspect Cirrus's work and nodded.
They should dry a little faster now.
Thank you, Bernard said.
He folded his arms, suppressing a shiver of his own.
You knew the men after Tavi.
There was another, too, a watercrafter. Your sister threw her out of the river.
Bernard snorted, a smile touching his face.
She would. I never saw that one.
I know them, Amara said.
She told him, in brief, about Fidelius and the mercenaries and her fears for the valley.
Politics.
Bernard spat into the fire.
I took a steadhold out here because I didn't want anything to do with the High Lords. Or the First Lord, either.
I'm sorry, Amara said. Is everyone all right?
Bernard shook his head.
I don't know. After that fight, I can't push Brutus too hard. He's mostly making sure that other Earthcrafter can't find us. I tried to look, but I haven't been able to locate anyone.
I'm sure Tavi's well, Amara said. He's a resourceful child.
Bernard nodded.
He's clever, fast. But that might not be enough in this storm.
He had salt, Amara said. He took it before he left.
That's good to know, at least.
And he wasn't alone. He had that slave with him.
Bernard grimaced.
Fade. I don't know why my sister puts up with him.
Do you own many slaves?
Bernard shook his head.
I used to buy them sometimes. Give them the chance to earn their freedom. Lots of the families on the Steadholt started that way.
But you didn't give Fade that chance?
He frowned.
Of course I did. He was the first slave I bought, back when I raised Bernard Holt. But he spends the money on things before he saves up to his price, or does something stupid and has to pay for repairs. I stopped having the patience to deal with him years ago. Isana does it all now. All his clothes get ruined, and he won't stop wearing that old collar. Nice enough fellow, I suppose. And he's a fairly good tinker and smith. But he's got the brains of a brick.
Amara nodded, then she sat up. The effort of it left her gasping and dizzy. Bernard's hand steadied her, warm on her shoulder.
Easy. You should rest. Going into water like that can kill you.
I can't, Amara said. I have to get moving. To find Tavi, or at least try to warn the Count at Garrison.
You aren't going anywhere tonight, Bernard said.
He nodded toward the darkness at one side of the cavern they huddled in, where Amara could distantly hear the howl of wind.
That storm came down, and it's worse than I thought it would be. No one's moving tonight.
She looked at him, frowning.
Lie down, he told her. Rest. No sense in making yourself more tired.
What about you?
He shrugged.
I'll be fine.
His hand pushed gently on her shoulder.
Rest. We'll go as soon as the storm breaks.
Amara stopped struggling against the warmth easing into her with a sigh of relief and let his hand push her down. His fingers tightened slightly, and she felt the strength of them through her skin. She shivered, feeling at once a sense of reassurance and a sudden spasm of raw physical need that curled in her belly and lingered there, making her heart speed up again, her breathing quicken. She looked up and saw in his face that he'd seen her reaction. She felt her cheeks color again, but she didn't look away.
You're shivering,
he said, quiet. His hand didn't move. She swallowed and said, I'm cold. She became acutely aware of her bare legs, brazenly on display, and curled them up toward the shirt, his shirt, that he had draped over her. He moved then, his hand sliding from her shoulder. He stretched out on his side, his chest against her shoulders, so that she lay between him and the fire.
Lay back against me, he said, quiet.
She shivered again and did, feeling the strength of him, the warmth of him. She had an urge to roll onto her other side, to press her face into the hollow of his shoulder and throat, to feel his skin against hers, to share that closeness, that warmth, and the thought of it made her shiver again. She licked her lips.
Are you all right?
He asked.
I'm...
She swallowed.
Still cold.
He moved. His arm lifted, then draped across her, careful, strong, drawing her back a bit more firmly against him.
Better.
Better,
she whispered. She turned, hips and shoulders, so that she could see his face. Her mouth lay a breath from his.
Thank you for saving me.
Whatever he'd been about to say died on his lips, and his eyes focused on hers. Then on her mouth. After a moment of aching silence, he said,
You should go to sleep.
She swallowed, her eyes on his, and shook her head. She leaned toward him then, and her mouth touched on his lips just a little rough, soft, warm. She could smell him, his scent like leather and fresh wind, and she felt herself arch into the kiss, slow and sweet. He kissed her back gently, but she could feel the faint traces of heat in it, feel the way his mouth pushed hungrily at hers, and it made her heart race even more swiftly. He ended the kiss, lifting his mouth away from hers, his eyes closed. He swallowed, throat working, and she felt his arm tighten on her for a moment. Then he opened his eyes and said,
You need to sleep. But you're half frozen, and you're afraid,
Bernard said. Quiet.
I'm not going to take advantage of that.
Her face colored, and she looked away from him.
No, I mean...
He laid his hand on her head and pressed gently down. His other arm shifted, moved beneath her head, so that her cheek rested against it instead of her own.
Just rest, he said quietly. Sleep.
Are you sure?
She asked. Despite herself, her eyes blinked closed and refused to open again.
I'm sure, Amara,
he said, voice a low rumble she felt against him as much as heard.
Sleep. I'll watch.
I'm sorry, she said. I didn't mean to...
She felt him lean down to her and press his mouth against her damp hair.
Hush. We can talk about it later if you want to. Rest.
Her cheeks still warm, Amara leaned back against his warmth and sighed. Sleep took her before she remembered drawing that breath in again. The light woke her. She still lay by the fire, but the cloaks that had been drying now lay over her, keeping her warm, but for her back, which felt as though it had just begun to cool. Bernard wasn't in sight, and the fire had burned low, but grey light shone from one side of the small cave. Amara rose, wrapping the cloaks about herself, and walked toward the mouth of the cave. She found Bernard there, still shirtless, staring out at a landscape shining in the pre-dawn light, ice coating every surface, every branch of every tree. Sleet ice mixed with snow lay over the ground, softening everything with white, making sounds seem closer, granting the land the strange half-glowing light of winter. Amara stopped for a moment, just to stare at the land and then at Bernard. His expression was hard, alarmed. "Steadholder?" she asked. He lifted a finger to his lips, eyes focused elsewhere, head tilted to one side as though listening. Then his eyes snapped abruptly to the south, at the still-shadowed trees that stood in silent, glinting stillness.
"There," he said.
Amara frowned at him, but stepped closer, wrapping the cloaks a little more tightly about herself against the cold outside. Winter had come in force with the storm. She glanced at Bernard and then at the trees he stared at so intently. She heard it before she saw anything, a low swelling sound that began to gather, to grow closer. It took her a moment to identify the sound, to sort it out into something she could recognize. Crows. The cawing of crows. The cawing of thousands of crows. Even as she started to shiver, they appeared, black shapes against the pre-dawn sky, from the direction Bernard faced, flying low over the trees. Hundreds of them, thousands, flooded through the air like a living shadow, blackening the sky, flying north and east over the Calderon Valley, moving with an uncanny certainty. With a purpose.
Crows, she whispered.
They know, Bernard said. Oh, furies, they always know.
Know what?
Amara breathed.
Where to find the dead.
He let out an unsteady breath.
They smell a battle.
Amara felt her eyes widen.
They're flying toward Garrison?
I have to find Tavi and Isana. Get back to the Steadholt, Bernard said.
She turned to him and took his arm.
No, she said. I need your help.
He shook his head.
My responsibility is for my holders. I have to get back to them.
Listen to me, she said. Bernard, I need your help. I don't know this valley. I don't know the dangers. I'm afraid to take to the air in daylight, and even if I got to your count alone, he might not listen to me. I need someone he knows with me. I have to get him to react to this as strongly as possible if there's to be any chance of protecting the valley.
Bernard shook his head.
This has nothing to do with me.
Is it going to have anything to do with you when a Marat horde comes down on Bernard Holt?
Amara demanded.
Do you think you and the people there will be able to fight them?
He looked at her, uncertain.
She pressed him. Bernard. Steadholder Bernard. Your duty is to your people, and the only way to protect them is to warn Garrison, to rouse the legions. You can help me do that.
I don't know, Bernard said. Graham's a stubborn old goat. I can't tell him I've seen the Marat in the valley. I don't remember it. His watercrafter will tell him that.
But you can tell him what you have seen, Amara said. You can tell him that you support me. If I have your support, he'll have to take my credentials as a cursor seriously. He has the authority to bring legion strength to Garrison to protect the valley.
Bernard swallowed.
But Tavi, he doesn't have anyone else to look after him. And my sister, I'm not sure she came through last night all right.
Are either of them going to be all right if the Marat exterminate everyone in the Calderon Valley?
Bernard looked away. back to the crows that still streamed overhead. He growled,
"You think someone's watching the air?"
"There's a full century of knights stationed at garrison," Amara said. "With a pair of infantry cohorts to cover them, they could stand off a dozen hordes. I think whoever has arranged this has a plan to assault them and destroy them before the Marat come."
"The mercenaries," Bernard said.
"Yes."
"Then there might be more people trying to stop us from reaching garrison. Professional killers."
Amara nodded, silent, watching his face. Bernard closed his eyes.
"Tavi."
He was quiet for a moment before he opened them.
"Isana, I'll be leaving them alone in this mess."
She said quietly, "I know. What I'm asking you is terrible."
"No," he said. "No, it's duty. I'll help you."
She squeezed his arm. "Thank you." He looked at her and said,
"Don't thank me. I'm not doing it for you."
But he covered her hand with his and squeezed quietly. She swallowed and said, "Bernard, last night, what you said, you were right. I'm afraid."
"So am I," he said.
He released her hand and turned to go into the cave.
"Let's get dressed. Get moving. We've got a long way to go."
Chapter 24. Isana heard a woman's voice say, "Wake up, wake up." Someone slapped her face, sudden and sharp. Isana let out a surprised sound and lifted her arms in an effort to protect her face. That same voice continued, just as before, "Wake up, wake up," and slapped her at measured intervals until Isana curled away from the blows, rolling to get her hands and knees beneath her and to lift her head. Isana felt hot, sweltering. Her skin had soaked with sweat, and her clothes clung to her likewise damp. Light was in her eyes, and it took her a moment to realize that she was on a dirt floor, that there was fire all around her. Fire in a circle, perhaps 20 feet across, a ring of coals and tinder that smoldered and smoked. Her throat and lungs burned with thirst, with the smoke, and she coughed until she almost retched. She covered her mouth with her shaking hand, tried to filter out some of the smoke and dust in the air as she breathed. Someone helped her sit up, hands brisk, strong.
"Thank you," she rasped.
Isana looked up to see the woman she'd seen in the rill water strangling Tavi. She was beautiful, dark of hair and eye, curved as sweetly as any man could desire. Her hair hung in damp, sweaty curls, though, and her face had been smudged with soot. The skin, in rows that reached across her eyes, was bright pink, shiny and new. A small smile curved her full mouth. Isana hissed out a breath in surprise, backing away from the woman, looking around her at the fires, a low ceiling, smooth round stone walls not far beyond the ring of coals. There was a door leading out, and Isana tried to stand and move toward it, only to find that her legs would not obey her properly. She stumbled and fell heavily onto her side, near enough to the coals that her skin heated painfully. She pushed herself back from the fire. The woman helped, dragging Isana back with a cool efficiency.
"Nasty, nasty," the woman said. "You must be careful, or you'll burn."
She sat back from Isana, tilting her head to one side and studying her.
"My name is Odiana," she said then, "and you and I are prisoners together."
"Prisoners,"
Isana whispered. Her voice came out in a croak, and she had to cough painfully.
"Prisoners where? What's wrong with my legs?"
"Cord holt, I think they called it," Odiana said. "You're experiencing crafting sickness. When Cord found you by the banks of the flood, your head was broken. They made me mend it."
"You?" Isana asked. "But you were trying to hurt Tavi."
"The pretty boy?" Odiana asked. "I wasn't hurting him. I was killing him. There's a difference."
She sniffed and said,
"It wasn't anything personal.
Tavi,
Isana said, coughing again.
Is Tavi all right?
How should I know?
Odiana said, her tone faintly impatient.
You tore my eyes out, woman. The next thing I saw was that ugly brute.
Then you're not.
Isana shook her head.
Cord took you prisoner?
She nodded, once.
He found me after the flood. I had just put my eyes back together.
Odiana smiled.
I've never managed my nails like that before. You'll have to show me how it's done.
Isana stared at the woman for a moment, then said,
We have to get out of here.
Yes,
Odiana agreed, looking at the door.
But that seems unlikely for the moment. He's a slaver, isn't he? This Cord?
He is.
The dark-haired woman's eyes glinted.
I thought as much.
The thirst in her throat abruptly became too much for Isana to ignore, and she murmured,
Rill, I need water.
Odiana let out an impatient sigh.
No, she said. Don't be an idiot. He's ringed us in fire, dried us out. Your fury cannot hear you, and even if it could, you'd not be able to dampen a washcloth.
Isana shivered, and for the first time since she'd found Rill, she felt no quivering response to her call, no reassuring presence of the water fury. Isana swallowed, eyes shifting around the interior of the building. Meat hung from hooks on some of the walls, and smoke lingered in the air. A smokehouse, then, at Cord's Steadholt. She was a prisoner at Cord's Steadholt. The thought chilled her, sent a quiver creeping along her scalp to the roots of her hair. Odiana watched her in silence and then nodded slowly.
He doesn't intend for us to ever leave this place, you know. I felt that in him before he brought us here.
I'm thirsty, Isana said. Hot enough to kill us in here. I have to get a drink.
They left us 2 tiny cups of water,
Odiana said, nodding to the far side of the circle. Isana looked until she saw the pair of wooden cups and pulled herself to them. The first she picked up was light, empty. She dropped it to one side, her throat on fire, and tried the second. It was empty as well.
You were asleep, Odiana said calmly. So I drank it.
Isana stared at the woman in disbelief.
This heat could kill us, she told her, struggling to keep an even tone.
The woman smiled at her, a lazy, languid smile.
Well, it won't kill me. I've drunk enough for 2.
Isana clenched her teeth together.
It makes the most sense, anyway. Use it. Call your fury and send for help.
We're far from any help, old girl.
Isana pressed her lips together.
Then, when one of them comes in...
Odiana shook her head slowly and spoke in a cool, passionless, practical tone.
Do you think they've never done this before? This is what slavers do, old girl. They left enough to keep us alive. Not enough to allow one of us full use of her fury. I'd try, it wouldn't work, and they'd punish both of us.
So that's it, Isana said. We don't even try?
Odiana closed her eyes for a moment, looking down. Then she said very quietly,
We're only going to get 1 chance, old girl.
I'm not a girl.
You're a child,
Odiana hissed.
Do you know how many slaves are raped within a day or so of capture?
The thought made Isana feel cold again.
No.
Do you know what happens to the ones who resist?
Isana shook her head. Odiana smiled.
Take it from me. You only get to resist once, and after that they make sure that you never want to try it again.
Isana stared at the woman for a long moment. Then she said,
How long were you a slave?
Odiana brushed her hair back away from her face with one hand and said, voice cool,
When I was 11, our steadholder sold my father's debt to a group of slavers. They took all of us. They killed my father and my oldest brother, and the baby. They took my mother, my sisters, me. and my youngest brother. He was pretty.
Her eyes grew distant, and she focused them on the far wall. Fire glowed in them, reflection.
I was too young. I hadn't begun my cycle or come into my fury crafting. But I did that night, when they took me, passed me around the fire like a flask of wine. It woke up, and I could feel everything they felt, old girl. All of their lust and their hate and fear and hunger, it washed through me, into me.
She began to rock back and forth on her heels.
I don't know how you came into yours, Watercrafter, when you first started feeling other folk, but you must thank all the furies of Karna that it wasn't like my awakening.
The smile crept back to her lips.
It's enough to drive one mad.
Isana swallowed and said,
I'm sorry. But Odiana, if we can work together...
We can get killed together, Odiana said,
her voice becoming edged again.
Listen to me, old girl, and I'll tell you what happens. I've done it before.
All right, Isana said quietly.
There are two kinds of slavers, Odiana said. The ones in it for professional reasons and the ones who take it personally. Professionals work for the consortium. They don't allow anyone to damage or use their merchandise, unless it's as discipline. If they like you, they'll invite you to their tent and give you nice food and talk and charm you. It's the same as a rape, only it takes longer and you get a good meal and a soft bed afterward.
That's not Cord.
No, it isn't. He's the other kind, like the ones who took my family. For him, it's knowing he's beating someone, knowing he's breaking someone. He doesn't want to deliver a high-quality product ready to work or pleasure. He wants us broken into pieces. He wants us to be animals.
She smiled and said,
When he takes us, that's just part of the process that he enjoys a bit more than the others.
Isana's stomach quailed.
Takes us, she whispered. He's...
The other woman nodded.
If he wanted to kill you, you'd already be dead. He has other plans for you.
She sneered.
And I saw some of the other women he keeps at this place. Rabbits. Sheep. He likes them helpless, not fighting back.
She shivered and stretched, her back arching sinuously, her eyes closing for a moment. She moved one hand to the throat of her blouse, tugging at it, pulling buttons open, the sweaty cloth clinging to her.
Are you all right?
Isana asked. Odiana licked her lips and said,
I don't have much time. Listen to me. For him, the game is breaking you, and to do that he has to make you afraid. If you aren't afraid, he has no power over you. If you're quiet and reserved, you aren't what he wants, do you understand?
Yes, Isana said. But we can't just stay here.
We survive for as long as you don't break, Odiana said. To him, I'm nothing but a pretty whore to be used. You, he wants broken. As long as you remain in control of yourself, he doesn't get what he wants.
What happens if I do break?
He kills you, she said. And he kills me because I saw you, and he hides the bodies. But it won't be an issue.
Why not?
It won't, Odiana said. One way or another. Hold out for a day, that's all. Because I promise neither of us will draw breath for half an hour if you break. That's why I drank both cups.
Isana fought to take a breath and her head spun.
Why you drank both cups?
Have you ever tasted Aphrodin, old girl?
She stared at Odiana.
No, she said. Never.
Odiana licked her lips, smiling.
Then it would have unnerved you, wanting when you knew you shouldn't want. At least I know what it's like.
She stretched again, unbuttoning her blouse lower, showing the soft curves of her breasts. She adjusted the fall of her skirt so that it bared one strong, smooth thigh and ran a fingertip along it.
Let's review our stratagem. I'm going to make them happy, and you're going to not care. There, that's simple.
Isana felt her insides twist, felt sickened as she stared at the other woman. You're going to... She couldn't finish. It was too horrible. Odiana let her lips curve into a smile.
The act isn't unpleasant, you know, in and of itself. It's rather nice. And I won't be thinking about them.
The smile grew a bit wider, and the whites showed around her eyes.
I'll be thinking of the pieces. The pieces left when my lord catches up to them. He will see to his duty, and then he will come for me, and there will be pieces.
She shivered and let out a soft gasp.
And there, I'm happy already.
Isana stared at the woman, revolted, and shook her head. This could not be happening. It simply could not be happening. She, with her brother, had worked the whole of their adult lives to make the Calderon Valley a place safe for families, for civilization, for Tavi to grow up. This wasn't a part of the world she had worked to build. This wasn't a part of what she dreamed. Tears welled in her eyes, and she fought to restrain them, to hold back the precious moisture before it fell. Without thinking, she reached for Rill's help and did not find it. Tears trickled over her cheeks. She hurt, deep inside. She felt horribly, utterly alone, with only a madwoman for company. Isana reached out for Rill again, desperate, and felt nothing. Again she tried, and again, refusing to accept that her fury was beyond her reach. She didn't hear the footsteps until they were immediately outside the smokehouse. Someone shoved the door open. The hulking, ugly shape of Cord and those of a dozen other men stood silhouetted by the light of the circle of coals. Chapter 25. Being captured, Tavi thought, was a twofold evil. It was both uncomfortable and boring. The Marat hadn't spoken, not to the Alarans nor to one another. Four had simply held spear tips to Tavi's and Fade's throats, while the other two trussed their arms and legs with lengths of tough, braided cord. They took Tavi's knife and pouch away, and searched, then confiscated Fade's battered old pack. Then the two who had tied them simply flung them over one of their broad shoulders and loped off into the storm. After half an hour of jouncing against the Marat warrior's shoulder, Tavi's stomach felt as though he'd been belly-diving from the tallest tree along the Rill water. The Marat who carried him ran with a pure and predatory grace, moving along the land at a mile-eating lope. He leapt over a stream bed, and once a low row of brush, evidently entirely unencumbered by the weight of his prisoner. Tavi tried to keep track of which way they were headed, but the darkness and the storm and his awkward position, mostly upside down, made it impossible. The rain turned into pelting, stinging sleet, blinding him almost entirely. The winds continued to rise and grow colder, and Tavi could see the wind manes moving in the storm, wild and restless. None of them came near the Marat warband. Tavi tried to mark where he was by the lay of the ground rolling by under his nose, but the storm began coating it in a layer of plain, monotonous white. He had no way of getting his bearings by the kind of rock or earth beneath him, no way to guide himself by the stars, no way to orient himself upon the lay of the land. Though he tried for an hour more, he gave it up as pointless. That left him with only the fear to think about. The Marat had taken him and Fade. While they appeared outwardly much like Alarans, they were not truly human and had never shown a desire to be so, and instead remained the primitive savages who ate fallen foes and mated with beasts. Though they lacked fury crafting of their own, they made up for it in raw athletic ability, courage that was more madness than virtue, and vast numbers that dwelt on the unknown stretches of the wilderness that began on the eastern side of the last legion fortification, garrison. when the Marat horde had rushed into the valley, killing the princeps and annihilating his legion to a man. They had been driven out only through heavy reinforcements from the rest of Alera and hard, vicious fighting. Now they were back, presumably to strike in secret, and Tavi had seen them and knew of their plans. What would they do to him? He swallowed and tried to tell himself that the pounding of his heart was the result of the battering he was taking on his captor's shoulder, rather than from the quiet terror that had taken up residence in him and slowly grew with every loping stride. An endless time later, the Marat came to a gradual halt. He growled something in a guttural, swift-sounding tongue and took Tavi from his shoulder, lowering the boy to the ground and stepping firmly on Tavi's hair with one naked, mud-stained foot. He put his hands to his mouth and let out a low, grunting cough, a sound that it did not seem possible for a human-sized chest to make. An answering cough rumbled from the trees, and then the ground shook as huge, heavy shapes, dark in the storm and night, stepped toward them. Tavi recognized the smell before he could make out the exact shape of the creatures. Gargants. The Marat who had carried Tavi, evidently the leader of the group, slapped the nearest gargant on the shoulder, and the great beast knelt down with ponderous gentility, teeth idly working over several pounds of cud. The Marat again spoke to the others and then picked Tavi up. Tavi looked around and saw a second Marat lifting Fade. The Marat carried him under one arm as he put a foot in the joint of the gargant's foreleg and half jumped up to the great beast's sloped back, where he settled onto some sort of riding saddle consisting of a heavy mat, woven of the same coarse cords as the ones that bound Tavi, made out of gargant hair. He tossed Tavi belly down over the mat and whipped a few more cords around the boy, as casually as any muleteer packing his charges. Tavi looked up at the Marat. He had broad, rather ugly features, and his eyes were dark, dark brown. Though he was not as tall as Tavi's uncle, his shoulders and chest would make Bernard seem positively skinny, and slabs of heavy muscle moved beneath his pale skin. His coarse, colorless hair had been gathered back into a braid. He looked down at Tavi as he settled onto the gargant, and the beast began to rise, without any apparent signal from its rider. The Marat smiled, and his teeth were broad and white and square. He rumbled something in that same language, and the other Marat let out rough, coughing laughs as they mounted their own gargants. The great beasts rose and set out at a swift pace in a single file, their huge strides eating up ground faster than Tavi could run, steady and tireless as the stars in the sky. Tavi could just make out Fade's shape, tied on the gargant behind them. He grimaced and wished he could at least be with the slave. Surely Fade was terrified. He always was. They rode for a length of time Tavi could hardly guess at, considering that he had been tied face down, and he saw little more than one leg of the gargant and the snowy white ground rolling by beneath him. A sudden low whistle broke the monotony. Tavi glanced toward the source of the sound and then up at his captor. The Marat shifted his weight slightly backward, and the gargant slowed its steps by degrees, coming to a ponderous halt. The Marat did not bother to have the gargant kneel, but swung from a braided cord knotted every foot or so down from the saddle and gave a low whistle in answer. From the darkness emerged another Marat, broad of shoulder and deep of chest, panting as though from a run. His expression seemed to Tavi to be sickened, even afraid. He said something in the guttural Marat tongue, and Tavi's captor put a hand on the younger Marat's shoulder, making him repeat himself. Once he had, Tavi's captor gave a short whistle, and another Marat from down the row of gargants swung down from his saddle, carrying what Tavi recognized as a torch, and a firebox of Aleran manufacture. The Marat knelt, holding the torch up with his thighs, and with a stone struck sparks from the firebox and lit the torch. He passed it over to Tavi's captor, who kept his hand on the young Marat's shoulder and nodded to him. Tavi watched as the younger Marat led his captor to a vague form in the snow. Tarvi could see little of it, other than that the snow over it had been stained with red. The mirage